Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It seems these days that when you turn on the television, you're listening to the news, the radio, you look at any kind of news source, the conversation is about one of two things. And lately, they've become one thing, and that's the economy and the 2008 presidential election. They've been conflated, really, into one issue. Today, we're going to be talking about not so much what you hear in other places, but what you probably won't hear anywhere else. And that is a conversation about how Christians should be thinking about this economic situation. Now, there are so many different levels of thinking here. First of all, we all tend to think immediately about, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for my family? Or what does this mean for my loved ones? The second thing I think we immediately think of is, what does this mean in terms of the future of our nation, our system, our economy? What does this really say? Are we in a moment of dire civilizational crisis, or is this something that that we'll look back on as a blip in terms of the historic play out of the economy in years to come? I think there's another issue, and that is the meaning issue. And that's where I hope we'll have some good conversation. Other things as well, but I hope we'll have some good conversation about the meaning of all of this. In other words, when the things that you take for granted begin to shake, to use a good biblical metaphor, what do you end up holding? What's really important? What's important to you right now? What is most important to you? What do you as a Christian believe is most important in terms of how you're thinking and acting and deciding and responding and analyzing what's going on in the economy? What's important to you? And how are you thinking about this? And what does this tell us about the great morality tale of the economy? I come back to this again and again and again. An economy is a playing out of moral conviction and moral value. That's where you see it. You literally know where our priorities are. You know this at the family level. You know, if you look at your budget, you really see a reflection of your priorities. It's true for a family. It's true for an individual. It's true for a company, an organization. It's true for a church. Look at your church budget. That's where your priorities are. It's true for government at every level. It's true for an economy writ large in terms of consumer spending, investment, savings, investment, and all the rest. You start looking at all this, you realize there are so many things for us to talk about that go beyond the alarmism, the confusion, the controversy, the blame game, and all the rest that's going on in so much of the media today. The conversation is going to start in just a moment, and you're invited to join by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Again, the number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news, big news out of Hartford, Connecticut. The Supreme Court there in Connecticut ruled just today that gay couples have the right to marry. That makes Connecticut, by the way, the third state behind Massachusetts and California to have a judicially imposed same-sex marriage law. And it has changed, of course, the outlook of the whole gay marriage issue across the country. When you have three, that's three out of 50. So we right now have 47 states without gay marriage, same-sex marriage, and three states with. The ruling comes just weeks before Californians are to go to vote on Proposition 8, which will be on the ballot there in the Golden State on November the 4th. And Proposition 8 would effectively reverse the decision of the California Supreme Court and would make very clear that in the California Constitution, marriage is the union of a man and a woman. Janet Peck of Colchester, who was a plaintiff with her partner, Carol Conkin, said, "I can't believe it. We're thrilled. We're absolutely overjoyed. We're finally going to be able, after 33 years, to get married." Very interesting. Another 4-3 ruling in this case. Just like Roe v. Wade on another big issue, you've got a 4-3 ruling that is a one-vote point I'm making with Roe there. You're looking at a divided court, but it's the majority that gets to claim the victory here. In the majority opinion, Justice Richard N. Palmer wrote that denying marriage to same-sex couples would create separate standards. Quote, "Interpreting our state constitutional provisions in accordance with firmly established equal protection principles leads inevitably to the conclusion that gay persons are entitled to marry the otherwise qualified same-sex partner of their choice." End quote. Now, that is really, really interesting because this tells us that the state Supreme Court there in Connecticut has decided that homosexual persons are a class of persons that are going to be covered under equal protection law. Now, that may seem like a small thing, but it's a huge thing. And the next question is obvious. Who's next on the list as a protected class? Because once you get assumed by the court, you're declared by the court to be a protected class, then all the equal protection issues then apply to you. It'll be very, very interesting to see where this goes. I think we have a pretty good idea of where it goes. Peter Wolfgang of the Family Institute of Connecticut made a very interesting statement. He said, even the legislature, as liberal as ours, decided that marriage is between a man and a woman. This is about our right to govern ourselves is bigger than gay marriage. That's true, too. This is the judicial usurpation of the political process. And I'm going to push that a little bit further, and I have something I want you to hear. A Republican governor, Governor Jody Rell, said she disagreed with the ruling. She said, the Supreme Court has spoken. I do not believe their voice reflects the majority of the people of Connecticut. Listen to this. However, I am also firmly convinced that attempts to reverse this decision, either legislatively or by amending the state constitution, will not be met with success. End quote. She did not say why. And I want you to hear me carefully when I tell you that what is happening on this issue, as on the abortion issue 30-plus years ago, is that you have liberal and moderate, as they would style themselves, politicians who are running under the cover of the court. In other words, they did not have the political courage to vote to say that marriage can be the union of a man and a man or a woman and a woman because they did not want to face the wrath of the voters. So instead, they will run under the cover of the Supreme Court of their respective state. That is what happened in terms of so much of what went across this country in the early 1970s when you could not have had a pro-abortion legislative attempt pass because, after all, the legislators would have been answerable to the public. So instead, the Supreme Court usurped the political equation and left the states defenseless actually to govern themselves on this issue. And then you had all kinds of legislators and no doubt many governors running around saying, well, the Supreme Court did this and now we're just going to have to live with it. When really, that's what they wanted. They just didn't have the courage to push for it. And that's a part of the brokenness of our entire political situation. So count one more state in on same-sex marriage. Count one more stake in the heart of marriage in this culture. And now it all turns again to California. Proposition 8 on November 4, we'll find out where California is going to stand on the issue. The voters at least will have their say. So no one in California is going to be able to say that the voters did not choose effectively now to say what marriage is and is not. At my website at albertmiller.com, I posted an article earlier today, in fact, very early in the morning, on plants' rights. When plants have rights, an idea, I said, gone to seed. We've talked about this on this program before because Switzerland amended its constitution in 1995 to say that the dignity of all living things had to be taken into consideration, and the all living things includes vegetation. But it's just now, in fact, in today's issue of the Wall Street Journal, that some of these issues are really coming, you might say, a push coming to shove in terms of how this lays out. You have now biologists and research scientists in Switzerland saying we can't do our jobs because we've got to worry about offending the dignity of a plant. The Swiss Federal Ethics Committee on Non-Human Biotechnology was asked to develop guidelines for plant dignity and plant rights. They produced a statement entitled "The Dignity of Living Beings with Regard to Plants." The most helpful part of their report is that they lay out four alternative worldviews. Theocentrism, which they identify as the basis for this position, is the idea of a God who is a creator, and therefore the creative ground of all living organisms. What counts for its own sake is God. All organisms count because of their relationship to God. End quote. That's a pretty good statement of the Christian biblical worldview. They called it theocentrism. That works. The second worldview is ratiocentrism. In this position, the issue of whether beings count for their own sake depends upon their potential capacity for reason and their capacity for abstract speech. End quote. Now, that means that the question is whether plants can think and speak. Unless you're watching a Disney movie, the answer to that is no. The third worldview they offer is pathocentrism. This position is based in the sentience of living organisms. They count morally for their own sake if they are sentient, that is, they have consciousness, and are therefore able to experience something in some way as good or bad. Now, believe it or not, a significant number of the people on this Swiss panel said that they believe that plants are sentient, that they have the experience of good and bad, They then go on and list the fourth alternative as biocentrism. Living organisms should be considered morally for their own sake because they are alive, end quote. Now, the group reported something very helpful. They said, not one member held to theocentrism. Okay, what does that tell you? It tells you that when the Christian worldview is eclipsed, when it's abandoned, then all you have left is some kind of debate such as this about what dignity would represent. If human beings are not made in the image of God, and if we do not have dignity because we are the creatures made lovingly by a creator, then we're just one more multi-celled organism among others, and eventually the issue comes down to plants' rights. Of course, these researchers are making a good point. They say, what could be more unfortunate for a carrot than to be cut up, chopped, and put in boiling water? But so far as we know, the Swiss are still allowing that. Back to talk about the economy on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Concern about the economy can be represented in something of a set of concentric circles. Just think about the most personal issues and how those really play out, and then begin to follow out how it goes from the personal to the institutional, to the community, to the national, and then the international. And you understand that at every one of those levels, we're all interconnected. Right now, if you're listening to so much of the chattering going on in the media, you're hearing controversies, you're going to hear a lot of blame exchange, you're going to hear a lot of prognostication, a lot of fairly useless talk, I think. I want this to be a useful conversation. And thus, we're going to talk about the economy in terms of how Christians should be thinking right now. What should we be thinking? What should we be seeing others are not seeing? What should we be thinking about that others aren't thinking about? What should we be worried about that perhaps others are not worried about? What does this tell us about the great morality tale that is the economy? How are you dealing with this? When things are shaking, and right now there are a lot of things that are shaking, what's most important to you? What do you depend on when you can't depend upon the economy? We're going to talk about that today on the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. If your neighbor, coworker, the student sitting next to you in the student center asks you, do Christians have any particular take on this? What do you say? No, we're just in the economy like everybody else. We're just consumers, producers, workers, managers like everybody else. Or do we say, yep, we do have something distinctive to add to this conversation? Here's some things I think as a Christian we ought to be thinking about. Here's some things I think as a Christian we ought to be seeing. You know, here is how Christian truth applies even to the economy in a moment of significant urgency. Let me offer to you one big thing I think that is missing: the sense of absolute universal responsibility. See, I think the blame game is right now a moral barometer of the fact that none of us wants to take responsibility for this. I think it is also demonstrating right now how short our memory is. We think that times have always been good, that the economy has always been on the upswing. We think that a bull market is something that is the norm. We think that we are innocent of making decisions that contributed to all of this. And so it's easy to look at corporate executives, and there is plenty of blame there. It's easy to look at the manipulators and speculators of Wall Street. There's plenty of blame there. It's easy to look at the investors who have been pushing the limits with things like derivatives. It's easy to look at that, and there's plenty of blame there. There's plenty of blame to be taken to Congress. There's plenty of blame to be taken to every branch of government and to both parties. There's plenty of blame to go around. But a lot of that blame starts very close, like in the mirror, where we recognize we have all benefited by this economy. We have all benefited to some extent and to a greater and lesser extent to the kinds of decisions that were made that we now know could be catastrophic. We are living in homes, driving cars, working for companies, inhabiting space and consumer goods we are enjoying that are the fruit of an economy that was based upon overvaluation. Now when we're trying to find out what things are really worth, it turns out a lot of them are going to be worth less than we paid for them. But we wanted them at the time, whether it be a house or a car or an investment portfolio or whatever. I'm really concerned for a lot of people out there who are on fixed incomes, especially on investment-dependent incomes, and they're trying to figure out, what does this mean for me? And when we talk about an economic recovery, we are talking about something that will take some time. It always does. You can look at the kind of chart I looked at just a few moments ago that shows how the stock market, just in terms of the average ending level of the day for the stock market, has gone up and up and up and up and up and up and up since the 1920s. The problem is there are a lot of downs in that big overarching upward rise. And some of those downs last a matter of some years. And that can be extremely painful for some people. I think we're going to find out that there are people who are going to be very, very concerned about how they're just going to pull off life and their responsibilities during this time. I think it's going to be a stress and strain for the local church. I think you're going to see some real hard questions about giving, some real hard questions about budget priorities, some real hard questions about how the church begins to help its own members to cope with this. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. When someone says to you, is there a Christian take on this? Is there something that you as a Christian are concerned about that the rest of us maybe are not concerned about? Do you have anything to say? I think we've got a lot to say. I think we have a very great deal to say. I just don't think we're saying it. I think for one thing, we've got to start with the understanding that we as human beings are economic creatures, not because some sociological development happened, but because God made us creatures who can't take care of ourselves. When we are born as infants, we are born, by definition, lacking self-sufficiency. But the reality is, even when we become adults, we are still not self-sufficient. We can't take care of all of our own needs. We need other people to help us with those needs. And when we live together in a community, that's what the economy is. The economy is the transaction between persons making decisions in order to take care of their own needs. And sometimes beyond needs, wants. If you want something someone else has, if someone else has a talent to make something that you want, you eventually come up with a way of exchanging what you have for what you want, but the person who has what you want has to be willing to want what you have in order to make the transaction work. That's the economy. That's what happens when you exchange milk and eggs from one door to the other as neighbors. That's an exchange. That's the economy. But when you have a lot of people and a lot of needs, you have the complication of a massively developed economy with currency, with trade, with exchange, with rules and regulations, with investment and stocks and bonds and checkbooks and credit cards. You got the whole system. But it's still based upon the fact that we can't take care of our own needs, and we have to have some economic means of taking care of the needs of ourselves and our families and of seeking to prosper in this world. You know, there's something else that really bothers me about this conversation, and that's the way the word greed is being thrown around. There is a lot of greed out there. There's no doubt. The Bible is so clear about the sin of greed. It's not just a problem. It's not just a syndrome. It's not just an addiction. It's a sin. It's a violation of the holiness of God that we love things more than we love the things of God. And greed leads to acquisitiveness, it leads to injustice, it leads to all kinds of things. Greed is often the fundamental sin behind lying and deceit and everything else. But the desire to do better is not in itself greed. The desire to have more is not necessarily greed. It can be greed if one is willing to do anything unethical or unholy in order to get to where you want to be. And that's the big issue that's missing in so much of this conversation. When they say greed drove this, yes, but that greed includes the school teacher with the stake in TIAA CREF, an investment fund, a retirement fund. It includes all of us with 401ks. It includes everyone who's been a part of these businesses that have really begun to escalate, and you've got stock programs, equity programs that have made people rich on paper that aren't so rich now. We liked it when it was working. That's the point. In a Genesis 3 world, responsibility is everywhere. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the economy and how we as Christians should be thinking about the economy. What should we be prioritizing as our concerns? What should we be saying is a distinctively Christian understanding of these times? And what are we saying to each other? Are we using words of reassurance? Are we saying this is only a little historical correction? Or are we speaking in crisis language? You know, if you just have on the financial channels alone, I guarantee you, you're going to think in crisis language. But you got to look up and look elsewhere for a sense of grounding. The telephone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Mike. Mike, what are you thinking about this?
The whole thing boils down to the federal government's not responsible for a company's bad mistakes and bad debt, or an individual that buried himself speculating, I say, even on his family's welfare when he bought more house than he could afford.
Okay, so let's just think about that. As a Christian, how would you put that in terms of a distinctively Christian argument? Do you have something to say there in terms of why, as a Christian, you would feel that way?
God has taught us to be responsible for ourselves. I'm responsible for my relationship with my God. I'm also responsible for taking care and maintaining my own family in the eyes of God.
Okay. I appreciate the call, Mike, and Mike's pointing out the importance of individual responsibility, and that's a very important point to make. He's also talking about what you might call the law of sowing and reaping. You could just reduce that to cause and effect. I mean, the Bible says, what you sow, so shall you reap. So, in other words, when you make financial decisions that are good, that are honest, that are true, that are substantial and wise and prudent, then you should expect that there would be a gain by that over time. If you make decisions that are reckless and speculative and greedy and incautious, imprudent, then you should expect to suffer by that. And so what Mike's reflecting here is a very basic cause and effect morality, and that's right out of the Bible, just in terms of let the market, and that, to extend his argument, and this is an argument that's made by many, let the market punish bad decisions. And I want you to know that I agree with that 100%. In the sense that the market itself is a great moral determinator of what's valuable and not valuable over time. But I'll tell you, Mike, the reason why Congress acted and the president acted is because the American people would not put up with the catastrophic failure of these big companies, because it's not the way it used to be. Now, I'll tell you, this is the political pressure. Actually, there are two dimensions of political pressure that were on the government authorities. Number one, you have the risk, because of the government's involvement in the economy, that by doing the wrong thing or doing nothing, a complete financial catastrophe could come with a devaluation of currency and the wiping out of the banks, and none of us wants to see that. The fear of that. You know, there are people alive today who were alive in 1929, and they have the memory of what happens when you have that. And so you could be innocent. And this is where Mike's point has a limitation. And I, as a conservative, want to acknowledge this limitation. The limitation is, it's not just the decisions we make that impact us. It's the decisions made by others. If a giant company makes bad mistakes and it falls, and that closes down the bank where it was doing business, and my money's there, and I could have done everything right, and my neighbors could have done everything right in terms of being prudent and careful stewards of wealth and income and the rewards of labor, but it could get wiped out by someone else's bad judgment. The second thing is that when you look back in the 1920s, the investors were a very limited class of Americans. It was an elite of moneyed Americans. Very few Americans were in the stock market. Now it's the opposite. Almost every American's in the stock market. And again, you can be very prudent in terms of your investments. You can be in the most conservative kinds of mutual funds and in terms of equities. You can be very, very careful. You can be a very good steward, and you can be wiped out by someone else's bad decision. And that's why it's all the school teachers and bus drivers and plumbers and carpenters and workers at Walmart and you know, all the rest who would say and did say to the government, you've got to protect my investments. I work for this company, and all I have is the retirement fund that was built up there. It's not just the fat cats sitting in the CEO chairs, and many of them have acted nobly. Many of them have acted ignobly. And the reality is that the cause and effect issue in an economy this diverse is just very hard to work out in a way that's just. And boy, does that remind us as Christians of what it's like to live among thistles and thorns and mosquitoes in a Genesis 3 world. It's a mess. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, one of the things that amazes me is that when we talk as Christians about the economy, we just don't go back far enough to basic issues, such as Jesus saying, look, it's only money. Caesar put his picture on it. If he wants it so badly, give it to him. The things that are most important are the things that can't be bought. And you know, we all know that. We know to say that, and yet we don't think that when we look at the headline about the stock market, about the banks, about the financial system, or when we just sometimes in the dark wonder what we're going to do next week after this week. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK from Austin, Texas. Roy's listening on XM170. What are you thinking, Roy?
Yeah, this is just a great big reminder that we as believers should be satisfied with what we have and not let ourselves be deceived by prosperity teachers in the pulpit.
You know, Roy, I delight in that comment because, number one, certainly it's true. It's on the face true. The Apostle Paul said that he had learned to be content, and content is a tough word, and it's really tough to be content when people are telling you you ought to be discontented. But Jesus himself made very clear that we don't live by bread alone. Our treasure is not in this world's goods, but in the things of the world to come, that we cannot serve both God and mammon. I mean, we know all of that. And then you immediately said, you know, we've got to be very, very suspicious about the prosperity preachers. And that's obviously true. And I got to tell you, the biggest problem is not that their prosperity gospel is a lie. The biggest problem is that it's a false gospel. Because it is a substitute for the gospel that saves. But, you know, I got to tell you, I'm chuckling just a little bit about that, Roy, because I'm trying to figure out, if you're a prosperity preacher, what are you going to say Sunday? Let me tell you, I like my situation on Sunday because I get to get up and preach the gospel. That's what I'm called to do. And woe unto me if I don't do it. But if I thought my job was to preach a prosperity gospel, if I was of that ilk and that was my theology, I got to tell you, I don't know what in the world you say this coming Sunday. You know, okay, it's been a backup week. Now we're going to leap ahead. You know, I'm afraid that's just not going to be too plausible. And you know, maybe the judgment of the economy ends up being a theological judgment as well. You know, let's just think about that for a minute. Maybe what's going on in the economy right now is going to betray the fact that many evangelical Christians in this country have been living on a thin theology of optimism rather than the substantial theology of Christian hope. You understand the difference between that? Optimism is the thin theology that says things are happy, things are good, things are going to go from good to better. And the reality is the Bible gives us no optimism. The Bible is infused with hope. The great narrative of the gospel is not about optimism. It's not about pessimism either. Those are actually both unbiblical categories. It's about hope. And the great battle for the human heart is not optimism and pessimism, because that's an emotional or intellectual frame of mind that can change with new facts or a new conversation or, I don't know, just a new passing phase of the heart. But the great battle of the Christian narrative is hope versus hopelessness, and that's very, very different. The Bible uses hope language. We have a good and solid hope. We have a sure and effectual hope, because our hope is not in the economy. Our hope is not in the government. Our hope is not in our banker. Our hope is certainly not in our stock portfolio. Our hope is in Christ. Our hope is a person. And that is the person who has grounded our value in his atoning work, the person who has secured our future in a way that cannot be corrupted by rust or moth. It's the one who says, you're going to survive this because it's only money. Now, that's not an otherworldly Gnosticism that says we're not living in this world and we don't have financial responsibility and financial concerns. That's why when you get to the rest of the New Testament, you have, for instance, the book of James that mirrors a lot of what you find in the Proverbs, actually about how God's covenant people should think about material goods. And you'll notice that language is very honest about economics, as is the book of Acts. And you start looking at that and you say, we really do have a lot to say here as Christians. We're not left without something to say. I appreciate Roy's point. We should be content. That's absolutely true. And, you know, contentment right now, well, let's put it this way. You just line people up from your neighborhood. And you present the people in your neighborhood with the same economic facts. They're watching the same cable stations and channels. They're looking at the same financial pages. Who's able to get through this? It's the one whose hope never was in the market in the first place. Or, if we're really honest, it's the one who had too much confidence in the market but is now embarrassed and says, you know, that was a misplaced confidence. The only real confidence I have is in Christ. You know, this morality tale of the economy that's playing out before us, it really is a great opportunity to talk about such things as sin. What's the cause of this? Sin? Whose sin? Well, just about everybody's sin. And you know, it's really, really interesting. This ties back to something that Mike said when he called earlier, you know, talking about the people that bought houses they really couldn't afford. There are people right now who have done very unwise things. They've loaded themselves up with consumer credit. That's a really bad decision. They've loaded themselves up with things they can't possibly pay for. Well, that's the moral play out of the way things work. And that's just another indication of sin and what it means to be in a sinful world. And of course, the sin is writ large. There are people that entice people to buy things that didn't have the money to buy them. There are people that would give all kinds of terms that looked good up front but were disastrous, even catastrophic on the other side of reality. There are people who said, you need this, when we all know we didn't need this. There are advertisers and marketers and retailers and investors and suppliers, and you could go all the way down a daisy chain of economic actors in this, and every one of them is tainted by sin because every single one of them is a sinner, and in our sinful state, we are looking out for number one. And we are prone to do what is unwise and unjust in order to come out ahead. Is that an indictment of capitalism? No, because I believe that capitalism is still the least worst form of economics ever invented, because at least the free market enables people to make decisions rather than to have them made for them. The collectivity of power is far more dangerous than the distribution of power among citizens. But I'm also for it because more than any other system, it really does actually reward the right things and punish the wrong things over time. But in a week like this, facing news like we face, it's sometimes hard to think clearly about these things. But as Christians, that's what we're called to do. And we're told to be always ready to give an answer for the hope that is in us. That's first and foremost about the gospel. But let's remember, everything we talk about is for us an opportunity to talk about our sin and God's provision, and that's the gospel. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler program. It's really, really interesting, some of the things you'll see and have to talk about. And as you're talking about the economy, let me just encourage you. Think as Christians. And let me throw out some words, and we've talked about them on this program even recently, but let me just throw them out again because they are all too rare in the midst of this conversation. Here are a few words. Prudence. Investment. Justice. Honesty. Thrift. Those are things that in the Bible are honored and, of course, are over time rewarded. So is caution mixed with boldness. You look at that and say, how does that work? Well, just think of Jesus' parable of the talents. It's not primarily about economics. He was not pointing from our spiritual gifts to an economic reality. He was pointing from an economic reality to our spiritual gifts. But the whole point there is, there is a sense of risk that is involved in any kind of economic system, and that risk is the only way you ever get ahead. And this nation and its economy have prospered by the very careful and strategic and now sometimes reckless kind of balance of risk and reward. Now, the market is a great economic instrument. It's also a great moral instrument. It punishes bad decisions over time. Where does this end? I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I'm not an economist. But I can tell you this. It's not going to end until we find out how much things are really worth. And then the economy is recalibrated to that worth. What you have right now in terms of the intervention of the government is a way of staving off a catastrophic revaluation. But over time, that revaluation is going to take place. As a matter of fact, the revaluation may come out and the economy may be even stronger on the other side, because having worked its way through a lot of false valuation, having worked its way through a lot of bad debt, having worked its way through a lot of economic fluff that turned out to be meringue on top of the pie, then the economy may be stronger on the other side and there may be a great opportunity for economic growth. That's what we need to hope for. Not because we just hope for things to be well economically, but because love of neighbor means I want the person on the fixed income to be able to have enough for all that she needs. I want my children to be able to come into a world in which they're going to be able to prosper in terms of their marriages and families. I want a world in which we have more people moving out of poverty than moving into poverty. So love of neighbor compels me to say, I hope the economy does well. I hope the economy does well enough that the right things are rewarded and the right things are punished. But I also know in a Genesis 3 world, the perfect judge is not the economy. The only perfect judge is God alone. And that's a very different judgment. Come to think of it, that's the judgment we are to fear. And that should drive Christians right back to where we go whenever we go to ask the answer for a pressing question. And that's to Christ. And that's what makes Christian thinking Christian. Back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.